from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Obama says ISIS militants are on the defensive and are going to lose. The significance of Egyptian-Russian talks.
I think that what the Egyptians want is for the Americans and Western Europeans to worry that Egypt is going back into the Russian orbit.
A rights group criticizes Australian detention of child asylum seekers. And a new satellite is heading towards the sun. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. President Barack Obama says his request for new war powers to fight Islamic State terrorists will prevent the U.S. from getting dragged into another prolonged ground war in the Middle East. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
Speaking to reporters Wednesday, President Obama said the militants are on the defensive and are going to lose. Mr. Obama has led the coalition effort against Islamic State fighters using the same authorization from Congress that President George W. Bush used in going to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the draft resolution he sent to Congress, the U.S. leader indicates it is time to fight the war on the Islamic State his way, and he is calling for the repeal of the Bush-era authorization.
The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war, like Afghanistan or Iraq.
Mr. Obama believes the United States should not get dragged into another prolonged war in the Middle East, something he said is not necessary to defeat the militants. That is why a key part of his request would limit the president's authority to wage war to 3 years. Mr. Obama said the authorization at the same time would give him the flexibility he needs to go after the militants.
For example, if we had actionable intelligence about a gathering of ISIL leaders and our partners didn't have the capacity to get them, I would be prepared to order our special forces to take action because I will not allow these terrorists to have a safe haven.
The authorization would remain valid into the first year of the next president's term. At that time, the new leadership would be required to revisit the issue. In seeking authority to wage war, President Obama also wants to prevent new involvement in an open-ended conflict. The resolution has bipartisan support in Congress, but its provision allowing a limited deployment of ground troops is expected to fuel a strong debate in the weeks to come. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Members of Congress are calling on the Obama administration to expedite weapons to Jordan, an important Arab ally on the front lines of the fight against extremists from the Islamic State. Jordan has intensified its fight against the jihadist group after militants burned alive a captured Jordanian pilot. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell reports.
Jordan is vowing to wipe out the Islamic State. The Hashemite Kingdom is ramping up its airstrikes, hitting Islamic State training camps, barracks, and ammunition depots. This operational tempo requires more weapons, and leading U.S. members of Congress are calling for increased support. Senator John McCain.
This committee's immediate concern is to ensure Jordan has all the equipment and resources necessary to continue taking the fight directly to ISIL.
Jordanian officials say they want revenge after IS posted this horrific video of a captured Jordanian pilot who was burned alive shortly after these scenes. The same day the video was released, Jordan's King Abdullah was in Washington seeking precision munitions, aircraft parts, and additional night vision equipment. Analysts say the arms transfers are crucial because Jordan is such an important ally in the fight against IS. David Shanker directs the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute.
Jordan is the best partner of the United States in this war. They are critical. They are the base of operations of all air operations targeting IS in Syria.
Ashton Carter has been nominated as the next Secretary of Defense and is vowing to cut red tape and solve any problems with sending weapons to Jordan.
I definitely want to find out what they are and resolve them because we need partners on the ground to beat ISIS.
Emotions are running high in Jordan, and analysts say public opinion appears to be solidly behind King Abdullah. Demonstrations are being held to condemn the killing of the pilot and express solidarity with the family. Analysts say there is agreement in Washington to strengthen the strategic partnership with Amman.
The relationship is extremely close, and there is a consensus between the administration and the Congress that more had to be done for Jordan, and in short order.
The United States will increase its annual assistance to Jordan from $660 million to $1 billion per year. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Security Council is expected to hear from UN envoy Jamal Ben-Ammar today about the unfolding crisis in Yemen, where he has tried to mediate political reconciliation talks. Shiite Houthi militia have been in control of the capital, Sana'a, since September. Last week, they dissolved parliament. The president and his cabinet resigned last month. Wednesday, the United States, Britain, and France announced the closure this week of their embassies. The French press agency quotes a Houthi official as saying the closures were unjustified. A foreign ministry official is quoted by the New York Times as saying the closures are meant to put pressure on the Houthis. Visiting Middle East professor Nabil Khoury of Northwestern University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, because of the security situation, diplomats concluded they could no longer carry out their duties.
What you have now is simply a recognition by Western embassies that they no longer have state with which to deal. They no longer have anyone that can guarantee the security of their diplomats. And given the deteriorating security situation in Yemen, they can effectively not do their diplomatic work anymore.
The Houthis insist they're not linked to Iran. Is that true?
No, that is not. They are definitely linked to Iran. The only question is how deep that relationship goes. We've known for some time that they have been encouraged by Iran, have received funding from Iran. They've also received training and advice from Lebanese Hezbollah. All Yemenis know that.
What does this do for the U.S. effort against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
That, unfortunately, remains the major preoccupation of the U.S. I fault this with contributing to the deterioration of the country because we were so preoccupied with following al-Qaeda that we didn't pay attention to the internal politics and the deterioration, and we did very little diplomatically to help keep the country together. I think the chaos which is resulting from Houthis fighting other tribes and fighting southerners will be good for al-Qaeda.
There are reports Saudi Arabia is arming Sunni tribes in the south of Yemen. Are we headed to a civil war?
It's not necessarily going towards a full-scale civil war. It may be going towards a secession, though. The Saudis have armed Sunni tribes before. They're going to help the southerners probably secede, partly because they can then have part of Yemen that owes allegiance to them and can work with them. At the end of the day, it's really not up to the Saudis or anybody else. It's up to the Yemenis. They will either try to work something out and stay together as a country, or they will break apart with all the chaos and fighting that that entails.
Given the turmoil in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, Khoury says the region is in a long period of instability, with the balance of power tilting toward Iran. Economic ties dominated the agenda during a two-day visit to Egypt by Russian President Vladimir Putin. At a news conference, Putin and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi also pledged their countries to work together to fight terrorism and signed an agreement reinforcing military cooperation. The security challenge facing Egypt was underscored by fresh reports of bombings at three police stations in the city of Alexandria and the deaths of a number of suspected Islamic militants during air raids in the Sinai Peninsula. This was Putin's first trip to Cairo in almost a decade, although he has met President el-Sisi twice since the military took power in 2013. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asks Mark Katz, professor of government and international affairs at George Mason University, how significant is Putin's visit to Egypt?
It certainly is significant. I think that Putin wants to show that Russia continues to be involved in the Middle East, and obviously he's been well received by the Egyptian government. So I think that it's meant to make a positive statement about Russian-Egyptian relations, and I think to a certain extent it has succeeded.
But what could Russia offer Egypt when its economy is suffering so bad?
Well, the truth is it can't offer all that much. Obviously, there is the arms package that the Russians have offered, but of course they want the Egyptians to buy it. Apparently, the Saudis have indicated in the past that they would do so, but they can't quite bring themselves to actually pay the money, and so it seems that the deal is not going well. Certainly, Russian-Egyptian trade is growing. Egypt is one of a very important buyer for Russian wheat, and of course, lots of Russian tourists visit Egypt. On the other hand, it's not clear that there are many further opportunities for them, at least not ones that would require a lot of investment, which under the current conditions, Russia really can't make that investment. And, of course, Egypt can't afford to pay all that much for Russian goods and services either.
How do you explain the Egyptian stress on restoring very warm relations with Russia at this point?
I think that what the Egyptians want is for the Americans and Western Europeans to worry that Egypt is going back into the Russian orbit, and so they will be very worried and will offer concessions to the Sisi government and learn to appreciate Sisi all the more. But quite frankly, I think that Western governments don't see Russia is in a position to offer Egypt much, especially now that Russia is increasingly preoccupied with Ukraine.
But would the rapprochement with Russia take away from U.S.-Egyptian strategic cooperation?
Talking to Egyptian officers, I don't think that they really see Russia as an alternative to America in this sense, that they would much rather continue to work with the U.S. What I do think, though, is that from the point of view of the Sisi government, to be seen domestically that Egypt can work not just with the U.S., but with a country that is at odds with the U.S., and there's nothing the U.S. can do about it. And I don't think the U.S. will do anything in retaliation, that the Egyptian-American relationship is very important. The curbs on American arms supplies that the Obama administration were made were actually not all that great, but it clearly upset the relationship. And I think when it comes right down to it, the U.S., although it's not happy about the way that Sisi came to power or the way he has ruled, in fact, the U.S. has very little choice but to work with him.
Mark Katz, Professor of Government and International Affairs at George Mason University. Friday, we plan to bring you more of his remarks on the Egyptian-Russian relationship. Australia's Human Rights Commission says the nation's long-term detention of child asylum seekers harms the children and violates international law. The commission has demanded a judicial inquiry into the practice. Australia's conservative government has rejected the commission's findings, calling them one-sided. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
For 10 months, the Human Rights Commission investigated the detention of children at 11 of Australia's immigration centres. It found a third of young detainees had developed mental illnesses that were so severe they needed psychiatric treatment. Its report, The Forgotten Children, states that other youngsters were the victims of sexual assaults or self-harm. The average length of detention for child asylum seekers is more than 400 days. The Commission says there's no reasonable explanation for the prolonged detention of minors and says there should be a judicial inquiry into what it calls a clear violation of international human rights law. Other activists support the Commission's findings. The head of the campaign group Children's Rights International, Alastair Nicholson, a former Australian Family Court Chief Justice, says the report is shocking.
This is, I think, one of the most disgraceful episodes in Australian history, the treatment of children in detention, and this is an objective and clear account of the evidence really should make us all ashamed of this behaviour. How on earth any Australian government could justify this on any basis is beyond me.
The number of children held by Australia has fallen sharply since the Conservatives came to power in September 2013. Prime Minister Tony Abbott dismissed the Commission's report, saying it should be ashamed of itself for being so partisan. Australia automatically detains all asylum seekers, while security, identity and health checks are carried out. Unauthorised arrivals who come by sea are transported to offshore processing camps in Papua New Guinea and Nauru as part of an official policy to deter boat people. Those who arrive by sea and are deemed to be genuine refugees won't be allowed to resettle in Australia. Earlier this week, Australia's High Court ordered the Immigration Minister to grant a Pakistani refugee a permanent visa after 3 years in detention and repeated government efforts to deny him asylum. The court said efforts to deny the man a safe haven in Australia simply because he'd arrived by boats were unlawful. Canberra grants about 14,000 humanitarian visas under various international refugee treaties each year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A new satellite is on a 1.5 million kilometer, 110-day journey towards the sun. Once it reaches its orbit, Discover, the Deep Space Climate Observatory, will replace an aging craft to monitor space weather. And it comes none too soon. 2015 marks the peak of the 11-year solar cycle, when extreme weather on the sun can most impact life on Earth. VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports.
3, 2, 1, 0. And liftoff.
Discover is headed to a place in deep space where the gravitational pull of the sun and of Earth cancel each other out. That makes it an ideal spot for the craft to monitor the sun. From this faraway outpost, it will document the continuous stream of charged solar particles. Thomas Berger is director of the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. He says while we are mostly protected by the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere, large-scale eruptions from the sun called coronal mass ejections can still be dangerous.
So those are really, really large magnetic clouds that are expelled from the sun at very, very high speeds. And when those impact the Earth, that's like a tsunami, if you will, or a hurricane impacting the Earth in terms of space weather.
Violent space weather can disable electric power grids, knock out satellites, interrupt radio signals and aviation communication systems, services we depend on in our daily lives. Full recovery from a really bad solar storm could take 4 to 10 years and cost between $1 and $2 trillion, according to a recent scientific report.
It's really not much we can do about it, given that the sun is a gigantic star and we're just a tiny little planet in its orbit. However, NOAA's job, and the Space Weather Prediction Center's job in particular, is to predict these phenomena and give people the watches, warnings, and alerts that they need to take mitigational action.
Discover will sit like a buoy in space. It replaces ACE, the 17-year-old craft that has worked long beyond its design life. Berger says Discover will ensure there's no gap in real-time solar observations.
That gives us between 15 to 60 minutes to warn people on Earth that a very strong storm, for instance, if we measure it at the Discover satellite, is coming into the Earth. 15 to 60 minutes is enough time for power grid operators to take mitigational actions such as spooling up other generators to balance loads. It's enough time for satellite operators to take their satellites into safe mode if necessary. So it's enough time. We'd like more, of course.
Plans are underway for more instruments to provide that earlier warning.
It would be great if we had something even farther towards the sun. And that's possible using perhaps solar sail technologies in the future. But right now, what we can do is put something in that gravitational sweet spot, if you will, and leave it there. And that's the Discover satellite.
Discover, like ACE, will issue planetary-scale predictions and warnings. NOAA plans to use ACE data, too, as long as the aging satellite survives.
We can tell you something's coming in. However, with the ACE data in the future and developments in models that are very exciting, the upcoming models we're developing, we'll be able to tell you exactly which regions of the Earth will be more or less susceptible to these incoming solar storms.
This will mean, for the first time, warnings will advise not only that a magnetic storm is heading towards Earth, but where it will strike. Discover also carries two NASA Earth Observing instruments that will gather a range of measurements for other science work. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 12, 1541, the settlement of Santiago, Chile was founded by Spanish conquistador Pedro de Valdivia. Today, Santiago is Chile's capital city and a regional financial center. In 1593, Korean forces expelled more than 30,000 Japanese troops in the Siege of Hangju. On this day in 1733, English parliamentarian and general James Oglethorpe arrived on the coast of North America with dozens of settlers in what would become the 13th American colony, Georgia. On this day in 1809, former U.S. President Abraham Lincoln was born. As president, Lincoln was successful at preserving the Union during the Civil War. Also in 1809, English naturalist Charles Robert Darwin was born. Darwin is best known for authoring the landmark 1859 publication, Origin of Species. On this day in 1914, the first stone was put into place on one of Washington's best-known landmarks, the Lincoln Memorial on the National Mall. In 1909, the iconic civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, was founded. In 1912, China became a republic after Emperor Pu Yi was forced to abdicate. In 1924, Rhapsody in Blue, a musical work by George Gershwin, was performed for the first time in New York City. On this day in 1999, U.S. President Bill Clinton was acquitted by the Senate of two charges, perjury, or lying under oath, and obstruction of justice. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent trip to Europe, Vice President Joe Biden reasserted the bedrock principle of a Europe whole and free, in which borders are honored, no spheres of influence exist, and every sovereign nation has the right to choose its own alliances. For many years, NATO invested in its relationship with Russia, hoping the country would one day emerge as integrated into the world economy, more prosperous and more invested in the international order. Unfortunately, said Vice President Biden, President Vladimir Putin has chosen a different path. Instead, the world has witnessed increased repression in Russia. Beyond its borders, Russia has violated the territorial integrity of Ukraine. In the face of Russian actions, the U.S. and its allies must remain resolute that no country should ever again be able to redraw the map of Europe by force. As long as Russia continues its current course in Ukraine, the international community will continue to impose costs. A peace agreement is worth pursuing if Russia adheres to it. But too many times, said Vice President Biden, President Putin has promised peace and delivered tanks, troops, and weapons. So the U.S. will continue to provide Ukraine with security assistance, not to encourage war, but to allow Ukraine to defend itself. It is fully within the power of Moscow, said Mr. Biden, to stop the separatists from pursuing the military solution. The trained fighters, they are directly answerable to Mr. Putin. The collective objective of the U.S. and its European allies, said Mr. Biden, must be to preserve the territorial integrity of Ukraine, to reassert the principle that borders are inviolate and nations have the right to choose their own alliances.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.